This week we are focusing on one topic, teaching for Black Lives. Let's bust some pencils.
This is Busted Pencils Radio, fully leaded education talk with Dr. Tim Slecker. Here's what's trending in education news.
Busted Pencils News, new edition. Welcome, substitute news person, Stick.
Hello.
Hey, well, Bonnie's out, so I don't know how much longer she's going to be out, but you are always welcome back to be the substitute news person.
Well, you keep bringing me M&Ms, so.
We love those M&Ms. Hey, take the news a little differently
okay. Today.
We've got three stories. Mm-hmm. First thing, I'm going to read the story headlines, and then we're going to have a quiz.
Oh.
You're going to be on the quiz side.
Okay.
Okay. So the first story comes from QZ.com. And this title, for 10 years, students in Texas have used a history textbook that says not all slaves were unhappy. All right?
Okay.
Then we're going to go to bridgemi.com. This is coming out of Michigan. History gets a conservative twist in Michigan social studies standards.
Okay.
And then we're going to go to Fox News Insider. A student raises red flags over history textbook's narrative on Trump and his supporters.
All right.
What do all these titles have in common?
I think it has textbooks.
Textbooks?
Textbooks.
Okay, what kind of textbooks, more specifically?
Like high school.
High school.
Textbooks, social studies.
Social studies, history.
Yeah, history.
There we go. There you got it. So, yeah, we've got three stories here all dealing with history and the controversy, though. And in one way, this isn't very interesting because a lot of people think they know history.
Yes.
Although we've seen on many Jay Leno's and there's lots of people out there who don't know anything.
Okay.
That's not where we're going, though.
Okay.
Okay. I'm not going to ask you Abe Lincoln's favorite color sock or something like that.
Black.
He didn't like socks.
They didn't have a lot of dye back then.
Well, and his socks, his feet were too big and he ran out of them. So, no. Texas. Right?
Yes.
Texas slavery. Let's take that first one.
Yep. Right?
10 years now, students have been learning something about slavery that is a bit problematic. For example, some slaves enjoyed themselves.
Of course.
Okay. And in fact, some slave masters were generous and nice.
Okay.
Well, some parents got a hold of this and said, yo, this is a bit problematic that you would put this in a history textbook about slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's trying to present what we would say is like this equal balance as if, hey, there were some bad slave owners and there were some good slave owners.
I'm sure there were.
You know, it's the Trump. Hey, there's, you know, good side, bad side.
Yeah.
You know, but this is a problem of when you talk to scholars about slavery.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of presenting it to students, there's no balance.
No, slavery was bad.
You're okay with making that statement?
Absolutely.
And as a student, and if you ever have children, God forbid, but if you ever do, you're okay with them learning specifically that slavery was a bad institution.
Not was, still is.
Okay, you're going to go deeper. I mean,
I don't need to go deeper.
The lasting effects.
There's still places that slavery is a thing.
Okay.
So, I mean, I'm obviously not here in the United States necessarily.
Right.
But, you know.
So you're not going to have a problem with this. So the defense here is that, well, it's an old textbook and the schools didn't have enough money to buy the updated textbooks.
Mm.
And so the updated textbooks, had the school bought them, would not have seen these types of references to slavery.
Okay.
So should we excuse Pearson, the publisher of the bad textbook? They made a good textbook, or should we come after the school for not getting the new textbook and continuing to use the old textbook? Or is this just maybe people were absolutely okay with that passage?
I think people were okay with it.
Yeah. You know, that's kind of...
And that doesn't surprise me.
So racism is alive and well.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So now Michigan, though, Okay, not Texas, mm-hmm. Michigan. Well, it used to be a blue state, but you know, we know how that all went. But
yeah.
People are upset, though, in Michigan about standards in the social studies that refer to Roe v. Wade,
okay.
climate change,
yep.
and our democratic values and principles.
Okay, yeah. I mean, those are all big deals.
Those are offensive.
Yeah. Wait, what?
So some state representatives in Michigan are putting forward new social studies standards that remove, for example, Roe v. Wade, climate change. These are issues that are debatable and offensive to conservatives. And so conservatives don't think that students should be mandated to learn about Roe v. Wade, about climate change, and about our democratic values.
Here's the thing. Like, that's a really important part of our history. It shaped our country. We're a democracy.
But according to these guys, it's shaping young minds to accept Roe v. Wade as something that we should all be celebrating. And there are pro-lifers out there, Stick, and this is offensive to them.
Okay.
Okay, and there are 0.3% climate change denier scientists out there.
How many?
It's something, yeah.
Point what percent?
I don't know, three.
Incalculable?
But there's some denial. Yeah. There's some debate, and we should not be teaching climate science. We should be teaching the debate.
Okay.
Okay. All right.
I did a research study on climate change 15 years ago.
Wait, 15 years ago?
Yeah.
And it was still pretty clear then?
Yeah.
Okay. The one, though, come on, let's be— Maybe some of this I can see from a conservative. I'll give them a little bit on Roe v. Wade. I'll give them a little bit on climate science.
Sure, yeah.
However, I'm not going to give a lot on this. But the one that I find offensive is they're offended by, quote, a phrase to our democratic principles.
Yeah.
Because that slants kids in favor of Democrats.
I don't see how it has ever in the past, because we've always been a democracy and we grew up learning about the democratic process and we knew it wasn't a party affiliation. It was just what the country was.
Yeah, so I guess according to these guys, though, any reference to democracy then now would be seen as favoring Democrats.
I'm unbiased because I vote both ways. You're pulling at hairs and straws and trying to split things here. Like, I can't understand how that would be a good thing besides just hiding words to keep people down.
So, again, another attempt of oppression, but here we are.
Yeah.
In another social studies book, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now, page three, or however you want to say it,
yeah,
next
right.
story. Holy crap, there's a book that talks about something— Well, and, you know—
I actually heard about this one.
Yeah. So people are offended because they feel that it's anti-Trump.
Yeah.
You know—
The book was by the people, A History of the United States.
Right.
And it's an AP history book.
It's an AP history book, and particularly this paragraph. Clinton's, that would be Hillary Clinton's, because it's referring to the election that mm-hmm. just happened in 2016.
Yep.
Supporters feared that the election had been determined by people who were afraid of a rapidly developing ethnic diversity of the country. They also worried about the mental instability of the president-elect and the anger that he and his supporters brought the nation.
Okay.
That offended some high school students who are Trump supporters.
Okay.
Because that's anti-Trump rhetoric, they think.
I can see where they are coming from, but I also feel like it's an accurate depiction of what happened and what was going on at the time during the election, because that's what history is about. It's not about, like, oh, that didn't happen because he won.
Right.
You're like, so what?
And they're also offended by the reference to that a lot of the voters were white.
And mostly older.
And older and rural.
Rural and suburban, yeah.
Okay, so that's offensive if you're a Trump supporter.
statistics are offensive?
Here's my problem. I'm offended by all three of these stories because what they actually are is, first of all, we're trying to demean, or not demean, but take away the effect of how horrendous and tragic slavery mm-hmm. was, and its effects are still to this day. The idea that in Michigan we're going to deny, in fact, keep things away from students, particularly the word democracy. And here now, the idea that somebody might have a critical look at the election of 2016 as being anti-Trump. Conservatives, look, you can't keep slavery in the textbooks
no.
as a good thing and have the 2016 election removed and glossed over as positive. That's not the way history works.
No.
Okay? Reality, fact-based, anti-racist, in your face. If you don't like democracy, get out, stick. That's all I got.
We are busting pencils!
This is Busted Pencils from Milwaukee Teachers Education Association, teaching all children.
He teaches ethnic studies at Garfield High School in Seattle, Washington. He's the editor of the book More Than a Score, The New Uprising Against High Stakes Testing. He's also an editor of Rethinking Schools, and now he is one of the co-editors of the new book, Teaching for Black Lives. Welcome to Busted Pencils, Jesse Agopian.
Hey, Tim, it's great to be back on with you, man.
Hey, I tell you what, though, I left out a whole bunch of stuff that I could have put in your introduction that would have been like the whole first 10 minutes of the show. How is it that you manage with little kids and to teach school? How do you do all this, dude?
Oh, man, I stay busy, man. I stay on the grind for sure. And I get a lot of help. You know, shout out to my wife, who is amazing and makes this all happen.
Well, then, yeah, because I think the first time you and I actually met in Seattle about 6 years ago, you had just had a newborn or close to it around that time. So, but hey, new book, Teaching for Black Lives. What's the motivation for anybody who's out there going, you know, I don't get it, Teaching for Black Lives?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a few motivations. One, I think we want people to understand that for Black lives to matter in this world, it's not just about police accountability. We need police accountability, and we can't just be shot down in the streets without any justice. But for Black lives to truly matter, Black education has to matter too. And unfortunately, in the United States, we have a system of schooling that's deeply infused with institutional racism. And I think corporate education reformers have claimed that all these new reforms that they want to bring to the public schools are about closing achievement gaps and helping Black and brown kids. And what we've seen is the richest people in the world, these billionaires like Bill Gates and Eli Broad, have used their money towards initiatives that actually have exacerbated racial inequality in the schools, things like charter schools and privatizing education, things like inundating the schools with high-stakes standardized testing that has actually fueled the school-to-prison pipeline by denying kids graduation. And so we're seeing education reform actually take our schools backwards. We're seeing schools segregated at highest levels since the civil rights movement, and we're seeing the active building of a school-to-prison pipeline in this country. And this book is about pushing back on that. It's about proposing policies that actually empower our Black students, things like restorative justice instead of zero-tolerance discipline that's part of the school-to-prison pipeline. And it's also about pedagogy, about how to connect with Black students in your classroom and empower those students to become change makers, to transform their education system and their world.
I was going to say, I mean, it is extremely bold in your preface where you and the other editors of the book point out very, you know, right in your, this is about creating action. This is a call to action. And more importantly, it's about creating action. And some people, I think, bristle at the idea that you are unabashedly saying that we want students, once they hear this, learn this, participate critically in this dialogue to then move out into the communities and enact this. Is that fair?
No, that's fair. I mean, the first line of the book that I co-wrote with Professor Wainow and Professor Diane Watson in this book says, Black students' minds and bodies are under attack. And if you realize that, then you realize that they have a right to organize and struggle and change their conditions. And, you know, there's a Black Lives Matter at School movement that's that's developed across the country. It started here in Seattle 2 school years ago. There was a teacher that designed a Black Lives Matter shirt for her school to wear in a celebration of their students. And then some hateful person made a death threat, a bomb threat against an elementary school for the audacity of those teachers to wear a shirt that said Black Lives Matter. And so I went to that teacher and said, we need to organize this movement across the city so that they can't intimidate teachers that are standing up. And we actually organized 3,000 out of the 5,000 teachers in Seattle that day to wear shirts that said Black Lives Matter. And from there, it picked up in Philadelphia later that year. And then last year, it went national. It went to over 20 cities across the country, holding a full week of action, Black Lives Matter at School Week.
Right.
And now the NEA, our union, one of the biggest unions in the United States, just voted to support it for this coming school year in February. And we want students to actively participate, right, to say my life has value and I'm going to be part of dismantling institutional racism.
Well, so let's take a look at the book. I mean, it's wonderful, first of all. You know, teachers out there, if you're listening to the interview, first of all, go to rethinkingschools.org. Look for the book Teaching for Black Lives. Order your copy today. And even though it's worth it, the things in there are amazing. But you've got five sections, Jesse. So section one, Making Black Lives Matter in Our Schools. What? Just give us a sneak peek.
Yeah, that section is really about looking at how the school system is set up in this country and looking at the social movements that many of us have been a part of to try to transform the public schools, defend them from corporate education reformers who want to profit off of the schools, the testing companies that want to profit off of the schools, and the charter companies that want to profit off of the schools, but also realize that we need to transform the schools, that there's always been institutional racism infused in the public schools, and we can do better. And so it's looking at social movements. You know, I wrote a chapter in that first section called Student Athletes Kneel to Level the Playing Field. And I tell the story about how shortly after Kaepernick took a knee to highlight police violence against Black bodies, the students at Garfield High School became one of the first high schools to have every single player on the football team, including the coaches, take a knee, and then the marching band and the cheerleaders. And then it spread to the girls' volleyball team and softball team, and it became a mass phenomenon. And that was part of what gave teachers the confidence to organize the Black Lives Matter at School movement. And so this section also looks at the policy statement from the Movement for Black Lives that wrote a brilliant statement about the direction that public education needs to go and strategies for challenging the school-to-prison pipeline.
All right, there's a nice sneak peek. Now, section two, we'll get this in right before the first break, and Enslavement, Civil Rights, and Black Liberation. What's happening in this section?
Yeah, so this is our historical look at Black history. And what we tried to focus on was telling the stories that get told wrong. We couldn't tell every single part of Black history, obviously, in this book, but we wanted to go to key concepts that are often taught in schools but often mistaught. So we have a section on the March on Washington and how it often gets taught having been just a platform for Martin Luther King.
Right.
And he did give a brilliant speech there, but oftentimes Bayard Rustin gets erased from that history. And he actually was the main organizing driving force of the March on Washington, but because he was gay, he's often been erased from the history, and we wanted to put him back front and center in that history, and celebrate the fact that Black people have intersectional identities, and that he, you know, we want to support the his legacy, and you know, we also wanted to fill in some gaps of things that aren't often taught as well. So the civil rights movement often gets explained as a couple of great leading figures, such as Martin Luther King or Rosa Parks. And while those are certainly important figures to teach about, it erases the fact that students and young people were the driving force in the civil rights movement. So we have a lesson on teaching SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And the kids do a role play in this activity where they actually travel back in time and become members of SNCC and have to debate the real questions that SNCC debated at the time. So they get a background into the organization, and then they have to debate, should we focus our organization on direct action, like the lunch counter sit-ins and the freedom rides, or should we focus on voter registration? What's the role of white volunteers? One SNCC member proposed bringing 1,000 white students from the North down to help the campaigns in the South, and there was worry that they might take over the movement. So how do we build allyship with white activists? And how do we work with other existing civil rights organizations? And you know, I've seen students really have their worldview transformed by engaging in that lesson.
Yeah, it is a rich section.
Right on.
We are talking to Jesse Hagopian. He is one of the editors of the new book. And section 3, Jesse, gentrification, displacement, and anti-blackness. What, again, a taste? What am I going to get from section 3?
Section 3 is so crucial for students to understand their own experience. I know where I teach at Garfield High School is historically in the Black neighborhood of Seattle, but it's rapidly gentrifying to where Black people can't afford to live there anymore after originally they were redlined and forced by banks to only live in that neighborhood, couldn't get loans to live outside of that neighborhood. And now being pushed out of the city. And this is something that's happening across the country in city after city. And this section helps students understand this concept of gentrification and displacement, not just in the American context, but also around the world. I wrote a chapter called Shock Doctrine Schooling in Haiti, where I recount my experience. I was actually in Haiti when the earthquake hit and survived, and it was horrific. You know, I
right.
saw many thousands of people die. But what was even more distressing was when I found out what their plan was for remaking the country and profiting off of the country and the school system, right? But there's a great article before that in our book called Bearing Witness Through Poetry, where Renee Watson makes connections between Hurricane Katrina and
I was just thinking about that, the connection between Katrina and now Haiti, which you're just saying, and the shock doctrine. We're going to take advantage of these catastrophes, and who's going to be the recipient of the benefits, and who's going to be the recipient of the, well, let's say, you know, the short end of the stick, people of color.
That's it. Yeah. And the students, you know, get that in their gut, but this really explains how that those processes work to extract wealth from poor communities in the U.S. and around the world and give them to people who already have too much. And so I think it's a really powerful chapter for kids to understand their own position.
All right, so let's move on. Section 4, discipline, the the schools to prison pipeline and mass incarceration. And anybody who's going, I don't understand the connections, then you haven't been around. But Jesse, this is a chapter right here. I think that a lot more, let's be honest, the policymakers either totally understand that this is happening or they're naive.
Yes, yes. And I want to get this in more policymakers and school boards' hands to read this chapter. I think it's really thorough in explaining what the school-to-prison pipeline is and how to fight it. Mm-hmm. The school-to-prison pipeline isn't some loose analogy. We see the construction of it every day. In Seattle, they're getting ready to make a $200 million youth jail to lock up kids, and they're in the process of constructing it this summer. Imagine what we could do with $200 million for homeless programs for youth, for after-school programs, for health care and healthy food to help our kids be successful in school. But we talk about in our book how the school-to-prison pipeline really starts with the curriculum. Mm-hmm. It starts with curriculum that whitewashes history and erases the struggles and contributions of Black people. And when that happens, Black kids often tune out. And when they tune out, they get labeled defiant. And maybe actually their defiance is better understood as resistance to a racist curriculum. I mean, and when I say that, there's concrete examples from the South to the North. In Texas, there was a textbook that was recently revealed from one of the largest textbook companies in the country that replaced the word slave with the word worker, implying that Africans were being paid for their labor, and put that chapter in the chapter on immigration as if Black people had come here looking for a better life rather than having been kidnapped.
Yeah. So they were immigrants and workers as opposed to captive slaves. Okay. You know, it's as you said, that's a whitewashing and it's a lie. It's an absolute lie. And it's, talk about Black children and being a white man and having white kids. It's as important or just as important, but boy, a lot of white kids need to understand the whitewashing of history.
Absolutely. I mean, I teach ethnic studies at Garfield, and I have an integrated classroom with white students, Black students, Latino students, Asian students, Muslim students, all different backgrounds. And the way they're able to build empathy for each other by learning the actual history instead of the lies is really remarkable. And if you don't do that, your students are going to check out, and they're going to say, This I'm being lied to, and I'm not going to pay attention. And when they do that, then they get sent to the principal, or they get suspended for being disruptive. And when they get suspended, they're more likely not to graduate, and then they're more likely to end up in jail because they don't have a job. And
well, there it is. I mean,
school-to-prison pipeline.
There it is. You laid it out. Boom, boom, boom. People are like, I don't understand the school-to-prison pipeline. What's not to get? Look, the curriculum's irrelevant. Student becomes distracted, gets labeled defiant, gets sent to the office, gets suspended, doesn't graduate, doesn't get a job. Next thing you know, they're in prison. Pretty easy to get. There it is,
Yeah.
Hey, Section 5 now. Here's where we're kind of bring this in. Teaching Blackness, loving Blackness, and exploring identity.
Yeah, in this section, we really want to take up intersectional Black identities, understanding that there isn't just one quote-unquote Black experience, that, Black women have a particular set of challenges and contributions that they've made to this country. That in this section of the book, we take up Black Muslim experience, and there's a brilliant chapter called Rethinking Islamophobia that takes up that experience. We have a section called Queering Black History and Getting Free, where we look at how Black LGBTQ folks are often left out of the curriculum, like Lorraine Hansberry and Bayard Rustin, and need to be put back in. Because you can't really tell the history of the struggle for Black freedom without those incredible figures who helped to make that happen. And, you know, Black Mexican identity as well is taken up here, and a wonderful lesson called Black is Beautiful to talk to younger students about why they're beautiful and why the beauty norms in our country are really racist, and we can support our students in loving themselves and seeing the many different ways to be Black in this country. And so I'm really proud of this book, and I love that it's so full of art to bring out each of these chapters.
Right, it's beautiful.
Yeah, our incredible production editor, Ari, went to work, and we have original art pieces from Black artists from all across the country who submitted pieces to, and this is our first book in full color. So these pieces get to be seen in their original full color. I think it's our fastest selling book in Rethinking Schools history.
Wow.
But I think people are hungry for these ideas.
Yeah. I think, and I tell you what, after listening to this interview, there are going to be more people with a lot more of that hunger. So the book is Teaching for Black Lives. You can go to the RethinkingSchools.org website to order your copy. And Jesse, I wish we had more time, but man, as we say here, you truly busted pencils, dude. Thank you.
Right on, man. I appreciate it. Yeah. I hope this book gets into a lot more classrooms and makes Black Lives Matter at school all around the country. So thanks for having me on.
This is Busted Pencils from Milwaukee Teachers Education Association, teaching all children.
Just got off the phone with Jesse Agopian, the author of Teaching for Black Lives. I am now, and you are all now, lucky to have with us Director of Equity and Student Achievement from the Middleton School District in Madison, Wisconsin, Percy Brown. Percy, welcome to Busted Pencils.
Thanks for having me back again, Brother Slecker.
No problem, man. So, hey, Jesse's talking about this book, and it's cool. You and I have been talking about this, and in fact, you actually have used part of Jesse's book, Teaching for Black Lives. Tell me a little bit about that.
So I was introduced to the book probably a couple of months ago. Once one of my colleagues actually purchased a few copies of it, and she was just like, "Hey, take a look at this." And then when I saw the title, I was like, "Oh wow, that's really powerful." Because the title of the book is "Teaching Black Lives,"
right?
And as an educator and working with youth for over 20 years, I have come to learn, and even being a history major and being broad field social studies certified to teach, I know that there's only been the dominant narrative in terms of how we teach history. And I always give kudos to Howard Zinn for introducing, you know, America's other people's version of American history, which is really illuminating the voices of marginalized populations in the United States. So I was able to briefly introduce to book this past summer to about 100 students that are in the 8th through 11th grade in our district. And what we had going on this summer was our second annual Student Equity Institute for Social Justice Leadership that we have run alongside our Equity Institute for Teachers. So that was my way to engage our students in the book. And it was actually our fifth grade teacher who said, "Hey, Percy, I want you to read this poem before you start doing your lecture on history." So I was, I had about an hour and 45 minutes to engage our students in the Howard Zinn's approach to American history, which was really cool. And let me tell you, you know, a lot of times people assume that kids' attention span is less than 10 seconds because, you know, they are so tech savvy and in the social media apps and Twitter with the 160 characters. But you know what? I engaged those kids in a lecture for about an hour and 45 minutes. And people told me this afterwards, but not one kid picked up their phone. No kid had their head down. Like, they were totally
hooked into it
and engaged.
But you opened this up with this poem.
Yeah, and the poem is called Two Sets of Notes. And I just want to read one passage.
Go for it, man.
From it, and it just resonates with me. And this passage basically says, I always take two sets of notes, one set to ace the test and one set I'll call the truth. And when I find historical contradictions, I use the first set as proof, proof that black youth's minds are being polluted, convoluted, diluted, and not culturally rooted.
Damn.
And that's just one stanza.
Who's the author on that?
M.K. Asante. And M.K. Asante, I'm just going to read this, is a best-selling author, award-winning filmmaker, recording artist, and distinguished professor.
So that line, though, when you just the way you said that in Howard Zinn and the approach to teaching with the kids, I mean, this idea of two sets of notes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's powerful.
Very powerful.
When you're talking about truly teaching American history, and then in the context of Black lives, the idea that I have to take one set of notes to pass the test, I have to take one set of notes for the truth. I get really concerned, though, about the fact that we're still taking notes to pass the test.
The test.
When we realize that the test material is actually the problem, and if we're talking about teaching for Black lives, does not, in fact, hurts Black lives. And in one sense, you and I have talked about this, this is the white privilege curriculum. The test is the white privilege curriculum, or am I jumping too far?
Or I would just, you know, sometimes people... You know, they get a little shaken up when you hear white privilege. And in all of the professional development that I do, I try my best not to use that phrase, but to try to educate my white colleagues in a way where they come to that concept of white privilege on their own.
But, I mean, I hear people now openly, white supremacy. I mean, mm-hmm. when you're talking about mm-hmm. the poem here, and the truth and the delusion and all this. I mean, we're talking about a curriculum of American history that is largely white supremacist.
Absolutely.
So how do teachers react, or do you not go that far, or you know?
No, I just
white fragility. I mean, here I am, I'm a white guy. Don't break me down, man.
So for me, if you start there by saying, you know, because you're white, you're privileged, that closes the door for a lot of people, right? So I my approach is to educate about racism by providing historical context, and I can use, you know, de jure racism or racism by law, all the way from the U.S. Constitution to the Homestead Act and all the laws that were passed through the Federal Housing Authority, which basically afforded all of these opportunities and advantages for white Americans to access and accumulate wealth, while at the same time, while the government was putting these benefits in place, they were intentionally excluding black people mm-hmm. by law, right? And a lot of folks don't know that history, so that's like the two sets of notes.
Right.
So if we frame it with the other set of notes without saying, because you're white, you're privileged, but using the other set of notes, if people are open-minded, they will come to white privilege on their own. And I've seen that happen. Because, you know, my dissertation is around, like,
right,
white privilege.
Right, Percy, just so in case, you know, the listener's working on his doctoral dissertation and somehow got me as his advisor. I don't know, luck
yeah, that's,
draw
that's true.
Or whatever.
That's been real cool.
He had
too.
To pick from the bottom of the bucket there. you know, this is a sensitive topic, though. And I mean, we're talking about school districts and just, you know, you're in a largely, I mean, what, 95% white faculty and staff?
Yeah, if not a little bit higher. It's a predominantly white school district. It's relatively affluent, probably the most affluent district in Dane County.
But with an entering kindergarten class, it's like 45% diverse and things like this. And so your students are there.
That.
It's pushing
Absolutely.
You. So you're in this cross. That challenge of helping teachers, I mean, is there resistance, though? I mean, you make it sound like I can go in, I can do this. Do you get any white teachers that say, Percy, come on, man, you and I are friends. Isn't that good enough?
It's subtle. The resistance is very subtle. And, you know, I come from a family of civil rights activists. You know, my dad's from the Mississippi Delta, and I did my undergraduate studies in Mississippi, so the way I understand issues of race and racism is a lot different than most people because I grew up in the North. I was a part of the desegregation efforts in the Madison School District in 1984, but I also have this rich family history of civil rights activism. So I think that gives me a different perspective, and it's kind of really helped me think about how do we, you know, push through that subtle resistance. And for me, you know, the first step before you can even get into the other set of notes is that you really got to help our white educators become self-aware.
Okay.
About in Dr. Billings, Gloria Ladson Billings, you know, in her work with critical race theory, introducing the idea of whiteness as property, right? So not pointing at you as an individual just because you're white, but because of systemic racism and how it has persisted historically and still living today, you know, this idea of whiteness as property is something that I've really taken a hold of. And it's not about you being white, but because you're white and because of how the systems were designed, you have access to property or power, which has not been afforded to me for well over 300 plus years. Right now, you can argue and say, well, what about the civil rights movement? And, and you know, you had a black president and, you know, nobody knows about the last 3 years of Dr. King's life, you know, where the nation hated him because he took a stand against Vietnam. When he did an interview, I think, on CBS in 67, which was 4 years after the I Have a Dream speech, you know, he flat out said in a lot of ways his dream had become a nightmare. So for me, you know, and that was the tail end of the civil rights movement. And if he was feeling as if his dream had now turned into a nightmare, how far have we really moved the needle? Because this beloved king that we celebrate every third Monday is not the king that America, you know, was thinking and considering when he was assassinated 50 years ago this year.
And that's the stuff that you ask your colleagues and students to wrestle with.
Yeah.
That you know, that other set of notes.
The other set. It's really about the other set of notes as a way to get them to understand this concept of white privilege.
Right.
So I use the other set of notes. Like, that really drives the content for the professional development that I provide for white teachers.
And so there's that access. So when people say, you know, hey, look, my faculty are going to be way too resistant to this idea. You know, they're upset. Or you're going to push them further away. It's like, no, it doesn't have to be that way. This is tough. These are tough topics. These are tough stances.
Right.
But there is, it shouldn't take us away from doing it.
No, we have a moral imperative to do that, right? And it's just really a matter of, you know, using those second set of notes to get people to understand the why we need to move in the direction that we're moving in. And, you know, I kind of call it, I was thinking about this morning, actually, racialized bondage. While people of color have to live and experience, you know, the subtle racism or the microaggressions every day, my white brothers and sisters have been in bondage due to lies. And you know, a lot of people don't look at it that way, but, you know, it comes down to that simple phrase, the truth shall set you free. And in order to bust that bondage that our white folks are engaged in, they have to have the second set of notes, because it's the truth. And even as I introduced, you know, the black history and spinning off of this poem with, you know, the near 100 students, you know, I said, look, and I said, I want you to do this in all of your classes. Don't take what I'm saying as truth. Our job as educators is to develop your critical thinking skills. And in order to critically think, you need to challenge everything that is put in front of you. So as I'm talking to you and exposing you to this history and the things that you've probably never even been exposed to or read in the textbook, I want you to go back home. I want you to Google. I want you to read whatever you can to try to challenge anything that I'm putting out there. And if you find something that contradicts what I'm saying, email me and I'll sit down and we'll have a conversation. Now, that's reciprocity of power, right? Empowering the student, which is something that I truly value. And the way education is designed, we don't value empowering the student. You know, we look at students as an empty glass and that we're supposed to be the water bearers and we're supposed to fill them with knowledge as if they're not coming in with anything, and that we're not supposed to be questioned because we're the authority figure or the content expert. But I come with a different idea about that.
I would say you're Percy Brown. You come with that other set of notes, man. So with that other set of notes, we need to get back together. But thanks for busting pencils with me again today, man.
I appreciate your time, and I hope I didn't go over our allotted time, brother.
We ran a little long.
We are busting pencils!
Time now for our salute to legendary activist and historian Howard Zinn. This is your moment of Zinn.
Historically, the most terrible things, war, genocide, and slavery, have resulted not from disobedience, but from obedience.
My thanks to substitute news guy Stick, also Jesse Agopian, and Percy Brown. I'm Dr. Tim Slecker. Thank you for busting pencils.
Log on to BustedPencils.com for the latest trending news, blogs, past shows, and more. Subscribe to our podcast in iTunes and Google Play. And get daily updates by following us on Facebook and Twitter at Busted Pencils. This is Fully Leaded Education Talk. Busted Pencils Radio.